This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This was supposed to be the greatest moment of Manning Marable's career. After many years of research, the celebrated scholar's new biography of Malcolm X is just out, and stirring criticism, controversy, and praise, Marable was scheduled for appearances on TV and radio talk shows, an interview with the New York Times. His book challenges a great deal of what we thought we knew about the life and death of an iconic figure. But Manning Marable died just a few days before publication. We're going to talk with his editor at Viking Books, Wendy Wolfe, and with Malcolm X scholar Michael Eric Dyson. A lot of us read the autobiography of Malcolm X or saw Spike Lee's film. What parts of Malcolm's story do you want to know more about? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, what Katie Couric, Oprah Winfrey, and Glenn Beck have in common. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik will join us. But first, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Wendy Wolfe accepted Manning Marable's proposal for that book in 2005 and worked with him on many drafts that followed. And she joins us now from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for being with us. We're so sorry for your loss.
Good afternoon, Neil, and thanks. It was very moving to hear Manning's voice just a few minutes ago. We still feel his death tremendously, and I only wish that he were in this chair, not me, today, because he has so much to tell us about Malcolm, even more than it is in the book that he spent 20 years writing. But it's our privilege to be able to try to carry his legacy on.
Well,
and it's been remarkable to watch the outpouring of affection and generosity towards Manning and his work.
We are going to focus, as he would have wished, on his contribution. But first, I do have to ask, tell us a little bit more about what he was like, what you're going to miss about him.
Oh, Manning. Manning had a twinkle in his eye and, as one of my colleagues said, a twinkle in his voice. You loved hearing from him. He was upbeat to the end. He was always, I can take that on. Yes, we can do that. We can find that out. We can write that story. We can get this book to that person. We can nail that down. And, you know, after 20 years of working on a project, a lot of people come to hate the person they're biographing. I mean, it's not an uncommon experience. And Manning never, his eye never wandered from what he wanted to say about Malcolm and the fact that he admired this man so much. He said, I have come to terms with his many flaws, and many people will be unhappy about some of the things that I'm going to be saying about them. And believe me, they are. But I admire him, and I think he would say he had so much else. Malcolm had so much else he could have done had he not been killed at the age of 39.
And 39, that's what, yeah.
Had his voice not been silenced. Yeah.
In the acknowledgments to the book, Manning Marable thanks you for your support through the evolution of the manuscript. Tell us a little bit about that process, the evolution.
Well, with any book, there is an evolving process. And with a life, there is the decision of how much to say and how much not to say. How much do you chronologically put into the book? How many days do you account? How many days do you miss? But with a book like this that also had an important history to tell, we had determined together how much of that context do we need. How many readers today know what the Detroit riots were? How many readers today know what a zoot suit was? How many readers today remember who Nkrumah was? I mean, we had to help determine how much of the surrounding history of the civil rights movement of America in the late 50s and early 60s, and in that moment in world Islam that we could pack into this story, because this was our chance to tell that story.
And was this book the product of the Malcolm X project?
Yes, it was. The Malcolm X Project was a multi-dimensional, multi-year project that Manning ran through his offices at Columbia with the help of many, many able and dedicated graduate students and colleagues to assemble data, to assemble documents, video footage, just anywhere they could find something, oral histories, interviews. The number of people who worked on this project was almost too many to list in the acknowledgments.
Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation. Georgetown University professor and public radio host Michael Eric Dyson, author of, among other books, Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X, and he joins us here in Studio 3A, and always nice to have you on the program.
Always good to be here, Neil, and I echo Wendy's words that I would rather it have been at Ben Manning himself, because he was so full of life, so zesty, and so brilliant, and so conversant with the issues, and would have spoken about this. And let's be real, he would have loved the response this book is getting. And, you know, seeing him on the front page of the New York Times, Beneath the Fold, last Saturday, Manning would have loved that, to engage a broader audience and to tell the truth about a complicated figure that he considered to be the greatest in the 20th century.
Well, let me just ask you about that title of the book you wrote. What do we now know more about the myth and meaning of Malcolm X?
Well, he's clarified both, hasn't he? Manning has done. Unfortunately, a posthumously issued biography, but one that he poured his life into. And the myth, of course, is that, as Manning argues in this book, the autobiographical narrative told to his amanuensis, his aide, his the person that crafted the story, Alex Haley, more Haley's book than Malcolm's book, Manning argues here. And he gives us copious evidence for that. Malcolm exaggerated his extensive hustling itinerary to the degree that he wanted to prove the redemptive power of Elijah Muhammad over a black person's life. So Malcolm had to say more about what he did and invent a lot of stuff in the streets to prove just how great Elijah was.
So he made himself out to be a much badder man, if you will excuse the expression, than in fact he was.
Yeah, I guess rap doesn't have a corner on that. So Malcolm X was really an inspiration for rap in so many ways they didn't even understand. So yeah, he exaggerated that itinerary. He got wrong some things deliberately, perhaps, about his hustling specifically with an elderly gentleman that in his autobiographical narrative was ascribed to somebody else. Turns out Malcolm himself was more directly involved in some of that hustling himself. And in regard to sexual favors to a particularly older white gentleman. And the domestic life of Malcolm X was much more complicated than either the film portrayed or that Malcolm himself referred to. So Manning Marable has helped demythologize some of that. But also, not only does he name the murderer of Malcolm X and people have focused on that, but he also talked about the NYPD having advanced knowledge of the plot to kill Malcolm. Not only did they not warn him about it, but they bungled the treatment of it and the handling of it after it occurred. So there's a lot of stuff there, but most of all, what we see about the meaning of Malcolm X is that in Manning Marable's eyes, and now in ours because of his book, Malcolm X was an extraordinarily complicated figure who was even greater than the mythology made him out to be.
Wendy Wolfe, let me ask you. We just heard Michael Eric Dyson refer to some of the information about Malcolm X's personal life, and there must have been some pause, some discussion. Do you include what? How important is it that he had a homosexual affair as a young man? How important is it that he was unfaithful? How important are those things?
Well, I think Manning was very careful to say, I want to tell the truth. I want to put the facts out there as opposed to the myths, but I don't want to make too much of them, and I don't want the book to be skewed around that. I mean, readers can read whatever they want, but Manning's task was a very complicated one. I mean, this is a 600-page book, of which probably 4 pages are devoted to sex, and, you know, 400 of the pages of the reviews will be devoted to sex. That's nothing we can't do anything about that. But I think Manning said, the myth, the prime myth we're dealing with is the one that Malcolm and Alex Haley, we have to say, started to create in the autobiography. I mean, you got to remember, Alex Haley is this Republican, he's a liberal Republican, a kind of a Nixonian Republican, who had A Jackie Robinson Republican. And he had an integrationist agenda, and he caught Malcolm at just that moment where Malcolm could have gone in any direction. He was leaving the Nation of Islam. He was rejecting their separatist nationalist agenda. But he was also coming back from a long trip to Africa, where he'd spent a lot of time with African leaders and learning what actual Orthodox Islam was like and learning about its humanism and its international outreach. Well, that was not something that was particularly appealing to Alex Haley. So I'm afraid he rather discarded that side and left you with the impression that Malcolm was heading into basically Martin Luther King's embrace. We don't know whether that would have happened, but I have my doubts.
And Michael Eric Dyson, one thing that Wendy Wolfe just referred to, that trip to Africa. Well, everybody who's read the autobiography or seen the movie knows about the Hajj and the visit to Saudi Arabia. This other visit to Africa, we didn't know about.
Not at all. It wasn't spoken of. It wasn't referred to. And it was quite central in Malcolm's strategy of trying to make certain that those whom he claimed to be victims of democracy, millions of African Americans, would receive justice in the international court. He wanted to bring America before the United Nations on the charges of its impulse toward genocide and its racist practices in this nation. And he met seriously with the heads of states. He was received basically as a head of state, so much so, provoking so much ire that somebody wanted to try him on some obscure rule that forbade Americans to go obscure in its application to black people, that forbade Americans to go abroad and argue as if they were representing the American government. He was that powerful and I think, obviously dangerous.
You're not allowed to conduct your own personal foreign policy.
Exactly, unless you're getting somebody out of the war or saving somebody like Jesse Jackson did Robert Chapman or somebody.
One of those kinds of deals.
Right.
There is also the aspect of this that he was trying to internationalize the civil rights movement.
Absolutely.
And that,
absolutely.
We don't use the word globalize was not used at that time, but internationalize this. And that was an aspect that we really don't think about very much.
Not at all. And he was doing it before Martin Luther King Jr. was in a strict sense, right? Because Malcolm X stood against the war in Vietnam before Martin Luther King Jr., who was inspired by his wife and Stokely Carmichael, subsequently Kwame Ture. But Malcolm X stood tooth and nail opposed to the war in Vietnam earlier than most black leaders publicly were able to say. Malcolm X understood the Pan-Africanist impulse behind the freedom struggles of African-American people here. He wanted to connect them, like Paul Robeson did, like W.E.B. Du Bois wanted to a broader African consciousness. And he wanted to revive a sense of healthy African identity away from the more viciously narrow politics that he saw operating within the Nation of Islam, where untutored and often uncritical acolytes were willing to perpetuate a legacy of inequality, ironically enough, in that particular cloistered religion as well.
Michael Eric Dyson is, among other things, a public radio host. He knows what that music means, and we have to take a short break. Wendy Wolfe is also with us, editor of Manning Marable's newly published Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Manning Marable's magnum opus, a biography of Malcolm X that's likely to be regarded as definitive for some years to come. The book was released on Monday, 3 days after Marable died of complications from pneumonia. In Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, Marable uncovered new details, some provocative, about the life and death of the man he called the most remarkable historical figure produced by black America in the 20th century. Our guests are Wendy Wolfe. She edited Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. We've posted an excerpt from the book at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Also with us, Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at George Washington University and public radio. Georgetown, isn't it?
Georgetown.
Sorry.
Yes,
okay. Public radio host. Among the books he's written, Making Malcolm, the Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X, and April 4, 1968. Let's get some callers in on the conversation. If you've seen the movie, Spike Lee's movie, if you've read the autobiography of Malcolm X, what more do you want to know about his life and career? Let's start with Steve, and Steve's with us from Caledonia in Michigan.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I hail from Mason, Michigan, the small town in Michigan where Malcolm was elected the seventh grade class president as the only black student in the city and in school. And I talked to some people not too long ago about some kind of commemoration, and I was shocked at just the lack of any knowledge of who he was. The name in some of the educators' ears rang a bell, but they really couldn't tell you much about him. And then my question is, are we seeing the same thing with Malcolm that we saw with Martin Luther King, that as time marches on, the focus is strictly on the civil rights aspect of their lives, and it misses the maybe the broader base, such as the mention of Vietnam, where I think Malcolm, from what research I've done, not only saw this as a racist homeland for himself and his murdered father, but as an imperialistic nation, a nation that made money off of exploiting weaker nations. And those things never mentioned. Martin Luther King was killed going to a union rally just a couple days ago, the anniversary. And somehow those things are never talked about. So I'm wondering, is the same procedure happening with Malcolm? Because to me, the homosexual act is inconsequential in his life. It may be interesting, but I need to see in today's economy and world people that saw things back in the 60s accurately. I think he did.
All right. Thanks very much, Steve. And I wonder, Wendy Wolfe, do you see, and did Manning Marable see, Alex Haley's book as, in a sense, the start of that process that we just heard about?
Well, I think it was the start of the branding of Malcolm, I would say. I was just reading a review of the book from England. It said one of the things that Manning does is he dismantles the brand of Malcolm. And a lot of people tried to get that. I mean, the Black Panthers had a certain brand that they wanted to propagate of Malcolm as the Black nationalist. Alex Haley wanted to brand him as an integrationist. Now, Malcolm was interested in domestic affairs. He gave a very important speech in early 1965, just before, I think it was 65 or 64, I can't remember. Anyhow, it's called The Ballot Versus the Bullet, and it's about the importance of voting and the understanding that there was a potentially great power in a Black voting bloc. This is long before the Voting Rights Act, and the Black people did not have the vote. He's not saying or else, but he's saying if these kinds of changes don't take place, there may be violence in the street, and you'll have to understand where it comes from. And he, the difference between, I think, Malcolm and Haley was Malcolm never looked to the white population for salvation. He did not think the answer was going to come through white-only institutions then embracing Black people. He thought change had to come in another way through an entirely different dynamic. Maybe it goes all the way back to his roots in Marcus Garvey. I'd be interested to know what Michael has to say on that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you think about that 1964 address, The Ballot or the Bullet, of course, and you think about that great address delivered in Detroit, Michigan, and Malcolm, of course, is in transition from one space to another. There's no question that he was capable, as the caller made quite quite emphatically the point, that Malcolm was not only an internationalist, but he understood the imperialistic dimensions of America's tentacles stretching out in the world. And he also saw the global, if you will, solidarity that could be generated not only among African and African-American people, but among people who were oppressed. And that's a very important point to remember, that he has wide vision. He had wide vision about people. He says, I'm for people who need justice everywhere. And it does seem to join with Martin Luther King Jr.'s notion that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. But ahead of King, the ballot or the bullet, which one will you choose? And he often put the responsibility squarely where it belonged. He didn't think that it was about African-American people being nonviolent. He says, if I'm the man you are, you want to know what I'll do? Ask me what you'd do. You know, if you were in my position, you'd do the same thing. You wouldn't be talking about nonviolence. You'd be defending your people. So why ask me to do something differently? And I think that's where Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X certainly diverged. And I think Malcolm X never gave up that particular instance of a specifically rooted African-American response to social injustice.
Obviously, he saw social injustice in the context of his experience in this country, growing up in this country, and the education that he'd given himself largely in this country. Did he, as he became more internationally aware, address issues that he encountered abroad? For example, as he looked at international socialism, you could see that the Soviet Union was not the paradise that anybody ever thought it would be. Did he ever address those issues? Did he address the oppression of women in the Arab world?
Well, yeah, he certainly didn't address the oppression of women in the Arab world. He was coming, as most men of that time, 1964-65, deeply and profoundly patriarchal, indebted to a belief that women's place was limited. But he did begin to open up. Malcolm was known initially to have said that the closest thing to a devil is a woman. But and then in conversation with others, he began to grow and mature. And I think this is what Manning Marable meant, that had Malcolm lived, he certainly would have embraced a much more progressive understanding of the role of gender. He did address some of the issues you're speaking about internationally. He embraced certain traditional socialist views, even as he moved beyond the narrow cubbyholes into which he had been consigned. But I think had he lived, he would have embraced a much more powerful democratic instance of those progressive views and would have been much more self-critical.
It's the other interesting thing about Malcolm is that Malcolm walks out of school at age 15 and never goes back.
Right.
So that's the end of his formal training. And yet by the end of his life, he's read Gramsci, he's read Trotsky, he's become an intellectual. And his capability to change and grasp new information, he goes off to Africa. He sees white people who are also Muslims. I mean, this is not something he saw in the United States, in the Nation of Islam. So he has this open-mindedness that will allow him to grow and evolve.
Jim is on the line with us from Eagle River in Alaska.
After a summer reading assignment of the autobiography of Malcolm X, I heard Alex Haley speak at Stanford in 1968. He talked about the interviewing process of Malcolm X as he was writing the book and how he was often quiet and reticent to delve into certain areas. But he noticed that as they were speaking, Malcolm would doodle on the napkins that he had by his side, and Alex learned to collect those napkins after the interview was over and found on the doodle a lot of things written down that Malcolm X had never spoken during the interview process.
Yeah.
I wanted to say one other thing, too, that it's almost a cliche that we hear, but I think I never have heard the statement spoken before, the phrase spoken before, by any means necessary. And I think Malcolm X was the first person to ever put that phrase in exactly those words.
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, that's a great point. He is associated with that phrase, much as Obama is associated with "Yes, I can," except that that was borrowed from Dolores Huerta and many other people, whereas Malcolm's originality, contrary to the president's, may stand the test of time. But the important point about the doodles, isn't it an inevitable and unavoidable metaphor that what Manning Marable has done in this book is to gather those doodles, is to gather, to scour the sources across the world, looking for every iota of evidence, every empirical fact-based assertion about Malcolm X, to really reconstruct them into a powerful narrative that is so elegant, and that's what he's done in this text as well.
I've been thinking about the autobiography, because I've been thinking about it a lot in the last few days, is, and people have said to me, well, do you think we should stop reading the autobiography? I said, under no circumstances. It's a remarkable text, and it should be required reading for everyone in America. But it is a text, and now we have a context in which to read it. We can see what got left out. We can read it with open eyes and not as some sacred text from which we should pattern our lives, but as a document of its time and in its place.
Well, I would argue even in the sacred text, you understand the context. A lot of things were left out. A lot of things were included. It don't mean you don't believe in Jesus no more. It just means that you understand that some guy who was a sexist was trying to make Jesus talk like one, and you've got to understand the context so you can understand the pretext and the subtext as well. Sorry for all those texts.
We don't take text messages.
Texting while interviewing is horrible.
Yes. I just wanted to read an excerpt. This is the central irony of Malcolm's career was that his critical powers of observation, so important in fashioning his dynamic public addresses, virtually disappeared in his mundane evaluations of those in his day-to-day personal circle. Especially in the final years of his life, nearly every individual he trusted would betray that trust. As late as November 1963, Malcolm did not recognize that the political path he had deliberately chosen would quickly lead to his expulsion from the Nation of Islam. This was apparent even to Ferguson, another person he's talking about in the book, in 1963. I felt eventually he would have to leave the Nation of Islam. He was just too political. He was developing too fast. And Wendy Wolfe, that sense of growing up within an organization, the Nation of Islam, and then finding out that everyone he believed in that organization, was something else.
But particularly one person, and that's Elijah Muhammad. I mean, he had an intimate relationship with Elijah. He was a father figure for Malcolm. He, you know, provided him with a kind of a model. And then Malcolm discovers that Elijah Muhammad is no icon himself. He's no model of purity. He is a kind of sexual predator, though that word wouldn't be used in those days. He had impregnated his secretaries, including a young woman that Malcolm had been in love with for many years. And Malcolm struggled with that. He struggled with trying to disassociate himself from the precepts of the nation that he was coming to see as being limited, but also how to leave Elijah Muhammad and how to make that break. He was also a son who was growing up to potentially be greater than the father, and that was dangerous to Elijah Muhammad.
And then we get into Michael Eric Dyson, the controversies, and there will always be controversies surrounding the assassination of Malcolm X.
No doubt about it. And I think the fact is that Manning's courage in fingering the person who did not serve time in jail is remarkable. And equally remarkable is his courage to go against the grain and say, look, you know, police forces understood, knew what was going on, did nothing about it. And when people express outrage and surprise, I say, look, the FBI knew of credible threats to Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and never spoke to him, never told him, never warned him. If they didn't do that about Martin Luther King Jr., who was perceived, at least in death, and even then, as much more willing to pacify the broader culture and being much more willing to be nonviolent than Malcolm X, what would they do in regard to Malcolm X? And I think Manning Marable's courage here is especially noteworthy because he points out, he doesn't engage in conspiracy theories. He talks about his talking to an NYPD officer who said that the mentality and the mindset was of assassination. And I think that's the real thing that he's exposed here that needs to be grappled with.
The word he uses is convergence. There's a convergence of interests. There's a convergence of interest in the FBI, in the Nation of Islam, and in the New York Police Department, that it would be convenient to all of them if Malcolm weren't there.
And we need to note that the NYPD has at least said this book does not, let me quote accurately, Paul Brown, chief spokesman for the police department, said, as much as conspiracy theorists may press to reach a sweeping, unsupported, and untrue conclusion, the fact is the NYPD was not complicit in Malcolm X's assassination. It's gratuitously false to suggest that it was. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we go next to Krista. Krista with us from Traverse City in Michigan.
Hi. I listening to this, it's very interesting. I grew up, you know, in the white Midwestern with a very narrow view and idea of what Malcolm X was all about. And it wasn't until as an adult I read the autobiography series of Maya Angelou. And she talks quite a bit about first meeting him and then later on talks about what you guys were talking about earlier, his trip to Africa and his desire to make the civil rights an international affair and using the United Nations and appealing to the United Nations. And that was such an interesting concept to me to read that. It was something I had never heard of before.
And how did that change your thoughts, Krista, your development?
Well, I had only heard of him in the context of the Nation of Islam and as being always brought up as being rather militant. And reading her point of view of meeting him earlier in his life and following him through and then, you know, working with him more later on, it just showed that there was a whole lot more to the story and that his views changed throughout his life, and it seemed like the outside views, the views of other Americans, didn't necessarily follow along and still viewed him just in the one context.
I just wanted to pick up on that thought. Why is it, Michael Eric Dyson, so challenging to so many people to come to the realization that this was a man of many parts whose thoughts evolved?
Well, I mean, because as he says in his autobiography, we think.
as someone says in his autobiography.
Somebody in that text said that they won't let me turn the corner. And it's so true. It's such a powerful statement that really captures the mood of people, the hagiographers, the uncritical celebratory figures, the people who loved him as an icon, but they didn't see him as a man. So they won't let him evolve, change, grow. I used to think that I don't anymore. I believe that, but now I've come to a different position. And if it was difficult for people from within to do that, then imagine from people from without. And what I want to do is flip the young lady's point. Yeah, not only does it prove that Malcolm was evolving and changing, and maybe better than we thought. Maybe it shows you Maya Angelou was more radical than you believed.
That's an interesting thought, too. But it's interesting, Wendy Wolf, to some degree that same process has been done to Martin Luther King Jr. as well. Once he started speaking out against Vietnam, well, he was an unpopular figure by that point, not just across America, within the black community, too.
He becomes a very scary person. People you know, think he's diluting the cause. He's getting distracted. He's making alliances. He's taking his eyes off the prize.
Yeah, and that scared the heck out of people within the Nation of Islam and even the organizations that Malcolm got together after leaving the Nation of Islam as well.
We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson and with Wendy Wolfe. She's the editor of Manning Marable's newly published Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. If you joined us late, of course, Manning Marable unfortunately died just a few days before the publication of the book that is causing so much praise and controversy and criticism. We'll take a couple more questions about the life and death of Malcolm X when we come back after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few moments, what Katie Couric, Oprah Winfrey, and Glenn Beck have in common. NPR's David Folkenflik will join us. But right now, we're continuing our conversation about Manning Marable's biography of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, the product of 2 decades of work and research, arrived in stores 3 days after Manning Marable died at the age of 60. To remember Manning and his final definitive work, Wendy Wolfe, the editor of Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, and Michael Eric Dyson, public radio host and professor of sociology at Georgetown University. He wrote Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Vaughn. Vaughn with us from Kansas City.
Hello, good afternoon. First, I want to say that I'm really glad you all are having this discussion. Malcolm X is one of my personal heroes. I have the Spike Lee movie, I've read the autobiography, and I've read another book also about him. And one of the things that I've noticed is a lot of people will focus. He was very intelligent, very eloquent speaker. But something I'd like to know, is there anything out there that talks about his personal life, him as a husband and him as a father? Because that's a side of Malcolm that we really don't hear a lot about.
Wendy Wolfe?
Yes, there is a certain amount about that in the book. He was not a perfect father, and he was not a perfect husband. They did not have a Hollywood romance. It's nice to think of Denzel Washington and Angela Bassett and the cozy images of Spike Lee's movie, but I'm afraid that the reality was a little more realistic. Malcolm spent a lot of time away from home. Betty was under a lot of pressure. It was the Nation of Islam was not a place that was friendly to women. There were many children. There were constant money troubles. Their house was firebombed. There were death threats. This was a difficult, difficult life, and neither of them, as Manning portrays it, had perfect records. But I think the relationship that he portrays is a believable and an understandable one.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Vaughn. Let's see if we can. Whoops, I hit the wrong button. I apologize for that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Michael never does that. Mikey joins us from Denver.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In 1966, I was a senior in high school, and in order to graduate, we had to give a senior speech. My senior speech was on the Black Muslims in America. Prior to reading that book, I thought there was some way me as a white girl could save all the black people. After reading that book, I realized, no, he can do it. He's got a really good sense of how, whether or not you believe in Muslimness, but become a community. And I'm wondering how that book, if it did in any way influence, I've not read the biography, but just out of reading that book, I had tremendous respect for this man's intelligence and wisdom. It's like, take care of your own, be kind, be smart, be financially, apparently he wasn't, but be financially responsible. And I'm just curious how your guests see the Black Muslims in America book influencing the biography.
Michael? I'd like to answer that if I could.
Go ahead, please.
We've talked a lot about Manning Marable as a scholar, but Manning Marable also devoted his life to social justice. He was a social activist, and that's what drew him to Malcolm X in the first place. And I think if the only legacy of this book is that it changes the image we have of Malcolm, then it will be incomplete. I think what Manning would want most of all is for people in America today who still have troubles, where race is still on the table, where violence is an issue, where religion is an issue, to try to understand through the example of Malcolm, how people can learn and grow towards a kind of humanism. Manning was one of the most profound advocates of international humanism there was, and I think that subtext suffuses this project.
in indirect response to the woman's question, I think that it's extremely important to see that, yeah, doesn't it really betray the sense of panic around Malcolm X when he was as conservative a figure, in the best sense of that word, in terms of morality, in terms of self-respect, in terms of responsibility, in terms of all the big themes that the virtucrats now put out and the Republicans speak of and the Tea Party vaunts and claims to be real to them, Malcolm X was embodying that. So why didn't they see a fellow traveler, a person who said, look, it's about our internal self-recognition and our desire to clean up our own communities. So there was an extremely conservative one that I would argue with, but certainly an extreme conservatism there that the broader culture should respect in regard to all the things it says it wants to hear from black people. Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X were certainly arguing those points.
Well, just to extend Mikey's question, though, is it fair to say that that sense of self-sufficiency, no, we don't look to the white man to solve our problems, we can solve our own problems, that sense comes from Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam?
Oh, it's no question. And it came before them as well. Marcus Garvey talked about it. Booker T. Washington spoke about it. Frederick Douglass. Any black leader worth his or her salt certainly speaks about the necessity for policing our personal moral boundaries and talking about our own communities and self-help. Because without self-help, we'd often have no help at all. Martin Luther King Jr. the same way. The difference, of course, is that some leaders have also said that we must talk about the impediments and obstacles in the broader culture that prevent the flourishing of self-help. Because if you're existing in a culture where you can't even buy a store, where you can't even own anything, where you can't even participate equitably in the broader circle of American democracy, there's no sense about self-help because you've been shut down from the very beginning. But once that's solved, there's no question that that's where a lot of black leaders converge, and a lot of people don't acknowledge that.
Mikey, thanks very much for the call. I'm going to, I may be dangerous, ask sort of an open-ended question in this email from Sage in Portland, Oregon. What do your guests think made Malcolm X tick? What was the source of his motivation more than anything else? Michael Eric Dyson, you first.
He was unalterably and unswervingly devoted to black people. He loved blackness with a complete devotion and fidelity that are remarkable for their capacity to scare the rest of us. And I think in the embrace of that love for black people first and then for vulnerable humanity, he embraced the project of trying to reconstruct America and then the world around an image of fairness and justice. I think that's what motivated him, his rage, his desperate language to oppose American and then global imperialism, and his desire to hook up with others who believe the same that he did.
Wendy Wolf.
I would agree with that, and I would add to it that he had a curiosity about the world. He had a kind of a voracious appetite to engage the world, and that's what led him to break out of the confines of separatism, and that would led him to travel the world and to try to bring it into the experience of black America in the early 60s.
Wendy Wolf, the editor of Manning Marable's Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, which is in stores this week. Again, sadly, the author died just a few days before publication. We thank her for her time. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology at Georgetown University, public radio host, and the author of, among other books, Making Malcolm the Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. And we thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, David Folkenflik will join us from New York.